Okay, it's recording. Go ahead.
Well, good afternoon and welcome. This is Mike Harris broadcasting on veteranstoday.com, also broadcasting on freedomslips.com, Studio B, Revolution Radio. Today is Monday, February 7th, 2017, and we're pre-recording this show to be aired on February 8th, 2017. My guest today is the esteemed Benjamin Fulford. Ben, welcome to the show, sir. How are you?
Fine, and thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, and I get so much fan mail and so many people commenting that I need to have you on more often. But you know, in all honestly, I'm sort of a I don't want to impose on you too much because I know these things are arduous and they take some planning and some going, and I don't want to do that to a guest. So I'm just really glad that you're here, and we can discuss the current affairs as they unfold in the world.
I mean, I'm happy to be on when enough new news has happened, you know, because 3/4 of the news is new, right? So if there's enough news stuff to talk about, go ahead and get me on. But I don't want to just be regurgitating the same stuff over and over again, you know what I mean?
No, I understand. I read your newsletter today. And one of the headline things that jumped off the page at me was that actual pedophile arrests are going to begin next week. And we're not talking one or two. We're talking, you know, 70 plus. So, you know, what insights do we have onto this? What's going on there?
Well, look, what surprised me is that the local L.A. independent media reported last week that 474 pedophiles were arrested. And that's a huge network. And that didn't make it to the national news as far as I could tell, you know. I mean, that's huge. That's already happened. These people have already been arrested. And then there's another report about 32 more being arrested in the Caribbean. That's probably Jeff Epstein's island, you know. So, several different sources are all telling me that if Jeff Sessions is confirmed as Attorney General, that arrests will start in Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, and New York. And now, you know, the pedophilia thing may be what the easiest thing to act on because it limits to people who've been blackmailed because they've been having sex with children, you know, and the blackmail is used to, you know, for purposes of grabbing power. But what we all really want to see, of course, is arrests for 911 and stuff like that. But I don't know if that's going to happen yet.
Well, that's been my position for Donald Trump. And I've said this on the radio a number of times. If Trump truly wants to make America great again, let's have a legitimate 9/11 investigation and let's bring the real perpetrators to justice and then execute them on the Washington Mall, because that's what it's going to take. And what that would do, in my opinion, that would take and elevate the esteem of this country globally so much, because they would realize that the American people have finally cleaned house, that the country is no longer run by these criminals who've done these horrible things. And I think it would be just a benefit that would be far-reaching in its effects, both direct effects and very subtle, nuanced effects across the entire planet.
Oh, for sure. And the important thing right now is that we still have these non-government actors, who hire mercenaries and start wars and spew out disinformation. I mean, the case in point, of course, being ISIS, which we know is financed by people in Israel and Saudi Arabia and in the U.S., and it's not Islamic, and it's not even a country, and it's mostly a PSYOP, you know, based in Texas, as far as I can tell. Although they're doing real nasty stuff in the Middle East too. But this is not, we should not have people be able to do things like this on this planet. You shouldn't be able to just, you know, go to a country and start a war and steal resources. So until we can have, you know, enforcement against the owners of the large corporations who carry out these acts, you cannot have world peace.
Well, I agree, and I have to look at all of these interchangeable parts being connected to each other, because as long as the 9/11 perpetrators are walking around free, I mean, I don't care what they go to jail for. I want these guys executed. I want them hung. I want them taken. You know, I want them to cease to exist. But I mean, I think back on the example of Elliot Ness and the Untouchables, and how he tried to get Al Capone, and he couldn't get him on anything that he was doing. He couldn't get him on bootlegging, couldn't get him on any of the prohibition level crimes, but they got him on tax evasion. And so I'm kind of the same thing. As long as we can get these people off the streets and end them so that they can no longer inflict this great harm and damage to this country and to many, many other countries around the world. And your point is not lost on me, that we have non-state actors. We have wealthy corporations who, thanks to George H.W. Bush, who created the template for outsourcing strategic military and intelligence functions to private contractors. You know, it was okay back when the government was the only client, but now they've grown this into an industry, and the government is one of many, many clients. All these big, Fortune 100 companies partake and do these type of things in order to promote their business interests. They start wars, and it's really time to put the screws to these folks and make them stop.
I mean, there's one mercenary company in England, I think, that has 600,000 employees. I mean, that's bigger than most national armies, and the people they recruit are the most vicious veterans of regular armies. These are really dangerous people, and they're being hired by non-government actors to do things that are against international law, and that should not be allowed. That's basically, I don't mind if they have them as guards to prevent, oil refineries from being blown up and stuff like that. When they're, overthrowing governments so that they can lay a pipeline, that's a problem,
Well, that's exactly what's going on in Syria as we speak. And the pipeline is one of the key reasons for them wishing to depose Bashar al-Assad, who is a duly elected official of his government and or of his people. And I've been there. They love this guy. Mm-hmm. And but yet if you're Saudi Arabia and you want your pipeline to go through there, you will hire the mercenaries to go there and dress it up like anything you want. But the bottom line is that this is a private enterprise creating a warlike situation in a sovereign nation. And then I can't agree with you any more or more emphatically that this needs to stop.
Well, here's my worry about the Trump administration. We have the former chairman of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, as Secretary of State. Well, I mean, they're the guys who've been in Saudi Arabia and were probably involved in this whole push to, build a force, a pipeline through Syria. That is not right. I mean, I think that, we're going to have to really make a final settlement for the Middle East. And I think I've seen the outlines of how that could work now. Now I've been to Saudi Arabia. My father was the Canadian ambassador there back in the 80s. That Wahhab fundamentalist system they have there is the most alienating thing I've seen. And I've been to about 50 countries. I never felt as uncomfortable and alienated as I was by that system. for example, a man has four times the witness power of a woman. So it takes four women to equal one man in a court. So if a man accuses his wife of adultery, that's his word is good enough, and they take her out to the desert, bury her to the waist, and throw rocks at her until she's dead. That's what they do to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Too loud, And these people are, getting trillions of dollars to finance, expansion of this ideology, and that has to stop. Somebody has to go into Saudi Arabia and remove those people. And a lot of the Saudi royals, they're westernized and cosmopolitan, and they don't like it either. So maybe we'll have to plug our noses and work with them to get rid of these fanatics, you know?
I agree with you there on that. And I think it's a deeper problem than we know. And it just, again, points out to the moral hypocrisy of the U.S., where we go into countries, start wars in order to bring them democracy. But yet we support Saudi Arabia, which has the worst human rights record in the world. There's nothing democratic about it. It's very puzzling to me. And the other thing that you comment you made about ExxonMobil and Rex Tillerson is, according to sources at VT, ExxonMobil is one of the two largest purchasers of the stolen oil from both Iraq and Syria that ISIS was selling to. So in a roundabout way, ExxonMobil has been financing the civil unrest that's going on in both Iraq and Syria.
I think, though, maybe that a settlement can finally be reached here, but a couple of things need to be done. One, as if you look at the recent map of the actual power on the ground, you can see three zones of influence are now appearing along traditional ethnic lines. You have the Turkeys, expanding its areas of influence a little bit into Iraq and Syria. And then you have the old Persian Empire, extending through Iraq and Syria and into Lebanon, and then to the south of that, you have the Arab peoples. And these are ethnically different, linguistically different groups. And so maybe somehow a deal could be made to, stabilize the borders along these three, traditional cultural areas of influence. And then, if the Saudis want their pipeline to Europe, they can send it through their ally Israel, and the other thing, of course, is, Trump needs to crack down on Israel. And unfortunately, I don't see that happening yet. I mean, they've got to stop, stealing land, and they've got to get off this fanatic, religiously superstitious project to,
rebuild the Temple of Solomon is what it all comes down to. That's what the religious fanatics really want.
Well, I say go ahead. They can go ahead and build their goddamn temple, and just leave the mosque alone, and get it over with, and stop, tormenting the Palestinians. I mean, the whole world is sick and tired of their behavior, and at the end of the day, though, the only way we're gonna be able to stop these people is when we cut off their money, and that means, of course, the biggest problem that we're still solving, which is the Federal Reserve Board, the process of creating and distributing dollars, euros, and yen. Has to be taken out of their control. That's what it really boils down to, and that's what we're waiting to see if the Trump administration is the real deal or not. They're talking about protecting the Constitution and all that. Well, they're going to have to get involved with that. And I've been looking into this issue for a long time now, and I realize that ultimately the trail now leads to the Vatican and to the Chinese. To a lesser extent, the Swiss. And it's at that level that, new negotiations have to be concluded. And in another way of looking at it, it's really, the big players now are China and the U.S. military-industrial complex, and holding the casting vote in between is Russia. That's what the situation is now. But I think we can, if we can reach the deal there, then world peace is possible.
Okay. Well, I am judiciously optimistic when it comes to world peace. And we will have to see what the Trump administration is really made of. I mean, to campaign is one thing, and to make promises is one thing. But to actually following through, implementing, and executing on the promises you've made is something entirely different. And I really hope that Trump is up to the task.
Yeah, now, my worry about Trump is that his whole United States First viewpoint is not in touch with reality. I mean, yes, it's true that the United States has had its wealth drained and its middle class destroyed by globalist forces. And that is a legitimate U.S. interest that needs to be protected. They got to stop, you know, decimating the U.S. middle class and stop bleeding the U.S. wealth. Okay, you can, that's fine. But, you know, the United States is now only 15.7% of world GDP. That's according to the IMF on a real basis, purchasing power parity, and 4% of the world's population. And we've got a planet to deal with. It's not just about the United States. And we need, you know, stuff that architecture that transcends countries to deal with things like the destruction of rainforests, the overfishing, you know, the global warming people, we're trying to do that. I mean, they're lying about carbon causing global warming, but the idea of paying developing countries to protect forests is a good one. They should have just said, we want to do this to protect the environment, not, you know, through, because otherwise we're all going to, you know, burn. It's nonsense. But anyway, a deal was reached, and now Trump is sort of, the Paris Agreement, you know, like almost all the countries in the world signed on, and now the Trump people sort of thrown that in the trash can. But we do need to set up new structures to protect the planet as a whole. We're, you know, the United States is not an island, you know, it's not isolated from the rest of the world. It cannot be. You know, isolationism would be a disaster. Argentina tried that after World War II. They were the second richest country in the world after Switzerland. And they decided, oh, okay, we're going to stop imports. We're going to make everything in Argentina. And they have this, and they ended up, you know, with this really shoddy industria Argentina, and they became like a third world country over the years through this policy of closing themselves off. And here's the point, is that, and this is what the people in the Trump administration need to understand, is that, okay, the only way they can do what they want to do right now is to put tariffs on in the current system. And that would be a disaster. You know, it would be a long-term, it would be the long-term destruction of the U.S. economy for short-term interests. The other, Trump is saying that, okay, you know, we're, the dollar is overvalued. You know, China and Japan are currency manipulators. That's just not true. The problem is that when the U.S. dollar became the world currency, the U.S. was 50% of world GDP, and the interest of the U.S. dollar and the interest of the United States were similar. But now, you know, the U.S. is, like I said, only 15.7% of the world's GDP, and they're the biggest, most indebted country in the history of the planet. You require Chinese money to keep going. You know, that's a fact, like it or not. And what this means is that, you know, if the United States wants to nationalize the Federal Reserve Board, they're going to have to stop using the U.S. dollar. It's the only choice that makes sense. If they're going to try, like, in the current system, the other thing they can do is borrow a whole bunch more, and there will be people who will lend it to them, and this will cause interest rates to rise, and it'll, you know, be damaging to the world economy, and the U.S. will be even more in hock to the international bankers than it is now. So it's not really a good choice. So the real choice, and I keep pointing this out, is that they need to create U.S. Treasury dollars, government dollars, continental dollars, whatever you call them. If they do that, they can print all the money they need to rebuild their infrastructure, to pay for R&D, to pay for the military within the U.S., to pay for education, all that sort of stuff they can do without taxes and without debt. But internationally, if the United States wants to keep their military presence around the world, there's going to be a need to create something that will finance this internationally. And that means coming up with a new sort of setup. And, you know, the Chinese, the Asians, who are the world's biggest creditors, are willing to set up a new sort of future planning agency that would cover the costs of the U.S. military operating around the world. in exchange for like a 50-50 power sharing agreement. And that's what, you know, I actually am involved in trying to negotiate.
Well, let's go back to the point about issuing a treasury-based currency. And, you know, I'm of the opinion that the U.S. should nationalize the Federal Reserve and just give the shareholders in the Federal Reserve a haircut. Just say, hey, tough, you've been fleecing the people for a long time. Audit the entire thing. You know, find out where the frauds have been committed. Claw back the resources that the American people have been defrauded of. That's my own opinion. But when it comes to issuing a currency, I don't see anything wrong with issuing a domestic USA script, you know, that you could issue from the Treasury, authorize, and use that for everyday transactions within the country. You can have dollars, or you can have, like you said, continental dollars, or whatever you want to call them. Yeah. And use that that's how they can you know, pay for these various you know, programs that they have, the social welfare programs, anything internal to the U.S. that doesn't interact with nations outside of our borders.
I agree completely with that. But the question still remains: what about this international dollar, euro, yen, sort of secret government power structure that's out there? I mean,
here's the shortcoming. Mm-hmm. You know, after World War II, when they signed the Bretton Woods Agreement, it all looked good. The dollar was in a good position, 50% of the global GDP. It made sense. And the question I have for you then is it time to abandon the dollar as the international reserve currency and go look toward some global currency that is only going to be used for transactions between nations or whenever you travel or something like that? Is it the right time for that?
Yes, but the problem is who controls this global currency? And you can have it where, you know, nobody creates currency anymore, but that's a problem too, because right now we have a system where, you know, I put out the documents on the internet for everybody to see how in the Lehman crisis, the private owners of the Federal Reserve Board created $23 trillion out of fraud and used this to buy real estate and corporate control around the world, having deliberately crashed world markets first to make it a bargain hunt, you know? And mm-hmm. That is fundamentally a criminal way to run the global financial system. It's fraud and it's criminal, and it shouldn't be. This is a very important planet, and it shouldn't be run by criminals of this sort, international gangsters. That's what they are. So what I propose is setting up a, you know, meritocratically staffed future planning agency that's completely transparent. Everybody can see who's in there, how they got to the top, and what they're going to do. And such an institution could have literally trillions and trillions of dollars they could use to turn the deserts green, replenish the oceans with fish, develop the Arctic regions, explore space, all that kind of stuff. So, and that means, again, to set something up means reaching a deal with the Asians. And they're ready, you know, for some kind of new structure like that. And the other thing is that, you know, I came to Japan originally because when I came in the 80s, it was by far the most successful country on earth. It had decades of double-digit economic growth. They had the lowest gap between the rich and the poor in any developed country. They had the environment so clean that there were, you know, there still are fish swimming in the rivers in downtown Tokyo, you know, which in the rest of the world at that time, rivers and cities were choked with filth, you know. And it was because they had a planning agency. It wasn't, you know, central planning like the communists did, because the work was actually done by the private sector. But the country as a whole had a vision. What are we going to be like 5 years from now? How are we going to make that happen? You don't have that system in the West. Singapore, the George Bush Sr. used brutalization, you know, shooting down passenger planes and murdering prime ministers to force the Japanese to dismantle this system. But places like Singapore and China still have it. And that's why Singapore, even though they're like filthy rich already, they still have high economic growth because they're still using that system that they copied off the Japanese with improvements, you know. And I'm saying we need such a system for the West, a future planning agency that could, you know, and there's so many things that could be done if this was unleashed. You could have a tunnel linking Alaska with Eurasia, and then you could take a train from New York to London, and the passing and the freight rates would go way down. You know, same, we could join Japan with Korea by land, by a tunnel. And there's so many things we could do. The Chinese are doing it around their borders and with their Belt and Road Initiative. That's a wonderful thing, but that needs to be done for the whole planet. You know, for Africa, for South America, for everywhere. All that kind of stuff can be done, but not with the current, you know, crickety institutions that were set up after World War II. They're just dysfunctional. That's the
problem we have is that the paradigm in the West is that the economy is a zero-sum game. And that is, if you're going to make money, someone else has to lose money. And that shouldn't be how it works. If you've, you know, we should be wise enough, smart enough to realize that if you have an idea that generates value, it creates wealth, that is, on its own merit, should be good enough to propel an economy. And we need to restructure the entire economic foundation of the planet based on just these things. But as it is today, we're living in a legacy type system that has outlived its usefulness, and it's not moving us forward in a productive way. And a point in case of that is, in the West, every generation, more and more money gets concentrated in fewer hands. It's like the West is playing the game of Monopoly. And whoever owns Boardwalk and Park Place is going to win every time. And we need to reevaluate and restructure the West economy as a subset of restructuring the global economy.
Absolutely. I mean, any gardener knows that sometimes you have to mow the lawn. Otherwise, you're going to have a jungle that's impenetrable, you know, for too long. And the Roman Empire was destroyed basically by excessive concentration of wealth. And this is now happening in the United States. And what you need is a reset once every 50 years, once every 70 years to you know, reboot the system, a jubilee. And that would be, you know, redistribution of wealth, especially the wealth that was fraudulently concentrated by the people who own the money printing presses. I think legitimate entrepreneurs who created value should be allowed to keep their money because they're, you know, they're making society better. They're making, you know, giving people smartphones or, you know, making life better. But the people who, you know, gathered control of the Fortune 500, through illegal means, and you know, these are the usual suspects, the Rockefellers, the Bushes, the Rothschilds and stuff. They need to have, 99% of their wealth redistributed to the 99% of the population they stole it from, you know?
Absolutely agree. And the issue with fraud is that fraud doesn't have a statute of limitations. If you've been deceived, you can go back into perpetuity if you can prove the fraud occurred. And I really think that the whole Federal Reserve has an excellent case for that. And I think that we could, you know, the U.S. government, on behalf of the citizens of the United States, and perhaps even some international players, global players as well, who've been hurt by this, have the illegal standing to go to a court somewhere and ask that this be redone. But I really think that the first step on that is to get Trump to nationalize the Federal Reserve and take it in-house in the Treasury, and then do a, from the beginning of the Federal Reserve to present day, do an audit and find out how much they stole and from whom, and then go get it back. Claw it back is the term. It's a clawback.
Mm-hmm. No, that's one way of doing it for sure. And I think that would be one part. I think this should be discussed, and experts need to get involved, because it might be easier just to, you know, do a reboot instead of going through this incredible legal and investigative process. But, you know, that's something for the technicians, the technocrats, to figure out what would work best. But it could be done within a year if you do it right. And again, though, you'd have to get the Asians involved, because part of the problem, having looked into this issue, was that when the system was backed by gold, gold, what had happened was that 85% of gold was owned by Asians because, you know, they've been accumulating it since Roman times. And Nixon said, all right, well, you know, we don't have gold, but we'll just use oil instead, because he didn't want all the power to be concentrated by these gold holding families in the East. And there's, a legitimate element to that. It's about world power, and that's why a 50-50 deal needs to be reached. And again, the Asians are happy to agree and provide the gold and the other things to back a new system. They just want to have a fair share. They don't want to rule the world. They don't want to take over. They don't want to turn us into Chinese.
And by the same token, they don't want to be ruled. I mean, that's only reasonable, if you ask me. And quite frankly, I like the Asian people. I like them a lot. I have so much admiration for them. You know, as I think I may have told you before, I've been a karate jiu-jitsu guy since I was 14 years old. I've been training, still train. And I just have to tell you, I have so much respect and admiration for the Asian mindset, how they think, how they act, politeness, the courtesy. They really are a very, very civilized people. And I don't see any issue, because if it's in their best interest, they'll work with us. They will go along. And I agree with your assessment on that. They're not here to take over the world. They're here to leave a better future for their descendants, for their children and grandchildren.
And you know, I've been involved with Asian secret societies, and their fundamental operating principle is, you know, universal love. The golden rule, stuff like that. Do unto others if you have others do unto you. And these societies can only be used for the greater good. So it's not like some kind of evil, Chinese gangster plot. There's nothing like that. It's really about, you know, make love, not war. But if you're going to try to rape them, they're going to defend themselves, you know?
Well, as everyone should. I mean, everyone should have the right to defend themselves when someone does something untowards to them. And I think that, you know, mutual respect and admiration is really the foundation for ushering in a new paradigm for all of humanity. I mean, we can't afford to go to war anymore because the wars are too destructive. Our weapons are too good. The lasting effects of things like Agent Orange or depleted uranium are too permanent that we dare not use these things. And yet, foolishly, the American military-industrial complex continues to do it. And I don't understand the motive behind it.
No, part of it is corporations manipulating the military-industrial complex to help them seize resources around the world. But we'll leave that aside for now. I was, you know, contacted by the Chinese intelligence contact I have with a message, to the Trump administration, because there are people like Steve Bannon who think that, you know, we can just use the superior U.S. Navy to kick the Chinese out of the South China Sea. Well, the Chinese are not stupid, and they're not going to fight you where you're strongest. You know, they're not going to waste, they're not going to allow you to destroy their Navy. What they're going to do is act where they're strongest. And they told me that if the U.S. tried to pick a fight, what their strategy would be is they take over India, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, and North Korea. And they could do it within a matter of months because they have this huge land army right next door to these countries. And these countries would probably roll over. And the Chinese told me that in the India-Chinese border war in the early 60s, they could have taken New Delhi if they wanted. They didn't bother. But, that's what they would do. And they wouldn't, they would leave Vietnam alone because Vietnam gave them a bloody nose in the 70s. But then, you know, Vietnam would find itself surrounded and would have to, you know, make, you know, like Finland, make a deal, you know, like Finland with Russia did, you know.
I do. And most people don't realize the history of Asia, that China has done this before. Where China has taken a land army and gone all the way down to Singapore. They have occupied Malaysia in the past, and we're talking hundreds of years ago. But it's stuff they have done. It's not out of the question. They know what they're talking about with great authority there.
And of course the U.S. could not stop them, and the Russians wouldn't, because Siberia is right next to China, and it's bigger than China, and it's only got 10 million people in it. you know, Chairman Mao used to talk about the Chinese-Finnish border, you know. And
if you're in the Kremlin, that's not a funny joke, but to you and I, it's pretty funny.
But the point is, the Chinese fear and respect the Russian military and don't want to fight, and the Russians, in the same way, don't have any motivation to fight China in the event of such a thing happening, you know, the Russians and the Chinese and the U.S. military, the people who actually do the fighting, all agree that such a scenario would be a disaster, because what the United States could do is they could, first of all, they could cut off the flow of resources to China from Africa and South America and places like that.
That's how the U.S. forced Japan into World War II, they cut off the flow of natural resources, primarily oil and other commodities, going into Japan. So the Japanese economy was grinding to a halt. Roosevelt forced Japan into World War II by doing that.
Yeah, that was the plan all along, because they wanted to use Japan. Anyway, we'll get into that maybe some other time, the historical stuff. But the point is that, you know, this scenario would be disastrous. So, and that's why the U.S. Military are not going to let, sort of couch cowboys in Washington force them into a war that would be a disaster for the planet. So it's not going to happen. That's the good news, you know. And what I understand, and the other thing is that, and this affects where I live, which is Japan, is that militarily, the U.S. bases in Okinawa are not very useful. They're too close to China. And strategically, they're just not that viable. There are some islands right in the middle of the South China Sea that are the most northern part of Indonesian territory. They're not their ownership is not disputed. They're Indonesian. Nobody else is claiming them. The United States could build a new naval base there, and it would be right smack in the middle of that, great sort of trading zone. And the Chinese, the reason, you told me before, the reason they're building these bases in the South China Sea is that their submarine base in Hainan is, the entrance is only like 50 meters deep, which means that satellites can watch their submarines come and go. And so they want a submarine base with an entrance for the submarine that's 2,000 meters deep, so that nobody can see their submarines coming and going. The reason for that is they don't want anybody to be miscalculate and think they could beat China with the first nuclear strike. They want to make sure that people understand that China would have the ability to strike back. And so no one would miscalculate and try a preemptive nuclear attack on China. So it's a legitimate interest of theirs. And I think that agreement could be made that let them have their base and let the Americans have their base. And then they could be, joint training exercises and stuff and be friendly with each other. Why not?
Well, I agree, but I have to ask a question that if let's just say hypothetically, we were to be successful in getting an agreement with the West and with the Asians, all of the Asians, not just China. China is the major player there, but with the Asians, to come up with some global currency scheme for trade between nations, while every country keeps their sovereign right to print their own domestic currencies. That would change the entire paradigm of what we look at and the compulsion and the reasons to go to war. It would really modify the whole foundation of the discussion in a significant way, to where war would be one of the least attractive options for everyone on the planet. And whoever the war maker was, the war monger, would be ostracized and would suffer without ever having to fire a shot.
Yeah, the Asians also understand that it's cheaper to feed a dog than it is to fight a wolf, right? So the military industry and the world's armed forces could be kept, and they could be kept busy playing war games and, exploring the universe and doing other types of stuff and fighting against poachers and bandits and, that kind of stuff. So that you don't alienate them and put them out of business, because then you give them an incentive to fight. I mean, I was approached by the some U.S. military guys very early on in this process I've been involved in, and they said, look, when the Soviet Union fell, you know, generals, powerful generals, suddenly found themselves working as taxi drivers in London. And they said, if that's going to happen to us, we'd rather go to war. So obviously, nobody's talking about suddenly defunding the military industrial complex, because that would, you know, create, give them an incentive to fight. And instead, it's, you know, a more generous swords to plowshares type thing we're talking about here, you know?
Well, I agree. I think the keys to the kingdom here is, how do we retool the military industrial complex and repurpose it towards something far more noble? Like, as you said, let's clean up the oceans. Let's reforest the desert. Let's explore space. Let's go out and mine the asteroid belt. Let's launch a ship to the five nearest star systems and see what's out there. Let's play the bigger game. And the key to this comes down to something. And, you know, Ben, you're Canadian by birth, and you know how things work in the U.S. I mean, our CEOs are judged on their performance this quarter. They have a 90-day window to perform. If they don't, they may be out of a job. We plan in five-year increments. It's time that we, as a race, as a people, decided to start planning in not just 5 years, but 25 years and 50, 100-year, 500-year increments. Because if we don't have a vision of where we're going to go, who knows where we'll end up. But at least if we can articulate a vision of what our plan is and what we want the planet to look like and what we want the race, the entire human race to be doing in 500 years, we're not going to get anywhere. We're going to probably destroy the whole planet and self-destruct.
And that's, you see, the problem with the corporate model is that their financial incentives are only for the corporation. It's not, they don't have a financial incentive for the greater good, you know. That's why we need something that looks out for humanity as a whole, for the planet as a whole, and corporations could then operate within that thing. And the other problem with the capitalist model is that it works fine if the real costs of doing business are added to it. But right now, corporations don't have to pay for the pollution they cause, or, you know, and so, you know, they can go around and destroy things, and it's more profitable for them to do that. But if you have the proper regulatory system in place, then, you know, the cost of cleaning up is included in the entire, you know, calculations the corporations make when they carry out a business. That has to be done. That, I mean, in places like Canada, we have such systems, but unfortunately for most of the world, they can just go and you know, fill up a big pit with toxic mine tailings and just, you know, poison the locals. And if they complain, you send in some mercenaries to shoot them. Well, that's wrong. You know, that shouldn't be allowed to happen.
And that's exactly what happens on a daily basis around this planet. So, anyway, what are your? I mean, we're in a really sensitive time right now because we're expecting things to happen. Let's take a different trip. What do you think of Jeff Sessions as a potential AG? Do you think he has the right stuff to do the job?
I hope so. I mean, the test will be, all right, they're going to go after, right here, the low-hanging fruit, which is the pedophiles. But let's see how far they take this. You know, are they going to, you know, start asking, you know, rounding up the Bushes, for example, and the really big players who've been, you know, international super criminals with total immunity until now, you know? And the other problem that he's going to have to deal with is that right now the people behind Trump, they're talking about destroying the illegal drug business, and that creates a very, very powerful and very dangerous enemy. What they need to do is legalize it and regulate it so it's not destroying lives. You know.
Well, I think you have a very good point there, and that is legalize it or at least decriminalize it and take the profit motive out of it. You know, the cost of production for a gram of cocaine is probably 3 or 4 cents, but because it's illegal, it sells for $100 on the black market. Same with opium, ergo heroin. And that if you would decriminalize these things and make them as cheap as rat poison, you would find out what the demand truly is. And you wouldn't have the incentive at the dealer level, the ones who sell retail, if you will, to go out and increase their customer base by getting young kids hooked on drugs. It would go away because there's no money in it for them.
If it was regulated, for example, if it was legalized and regulated, for example, with heroin, right, you could mandate that a certain percentage of sleeping medicine is included so that people will fall asleep before they can overdose themselves, you know. Like safety can be put into this stuff, you know. Well, where it's illegal right now, you know, people are killing themselves regularly with this unregulated, you know, pharmaceutical.
Well, you know, we have the template to follow, and that is, you know, during Prohibition when alcohol was illegal, you know, currently if you want to sell alcohol either on the bulk level, if you want to sell bottles of you know, whiskey or stuff like that, you have to get one type of liquor license. If you want to sell, you know, a cocktail, that scale, that's another type of liquor license. So, you know, why not just apply this model, which obviously works because it's been in effect for a very long time now. It generates money, it generates excise tax, it helps feed the government, and why not reimpose that? And, you know, let's, my point here, let me finish. My point is that if you have to pay $250,000 to buy a liquor license to sell cocktails over a bar, and some teenager comes in, you're not going to risk your $250,000 investment by selling that kid a cocktail. You know, you're not going to do it. And so use that template, use that model, say, okay, if you want to be in the drug business of drugs, we're going to treat it like alcohol. And if you want to be a retail seller or a wholesale or a bulk seller, you have to purchase a license. And the license is going to cost you X amount of dollars. If we find you violating these terms and conditions and selling to minors, then you're going to lose your license and go to jail. You're going to lose your investment. And I know it'll work because nobody wants to throw away the fees for their liquor license. So make it expensive enough that it's going to incentivize these people not to break the law and sell to kids.
Yeah, and what I was going to add to your point here is that around the world, a natural sort of solution has been reached, which, for example, if there wasn't taxes making liquor expensive enough that people, in order to stop people from drinking too much, you know, you could sell a bottle of 100% alcohol for 50 cents if there wasn't that built-in financial disincentive. You know, the same with tobacco, right? They put the price up high enough to try to limit consumption, and that can be done, you know. And the money generated can be used to finance doctors and other things to help people with problems caused by these substances, you know. And I think Canada, they're now going through the process of legalizing marijuana, and I'm sure they're going to, you know, study what's happened in Colorado. And you know, they're going to try different models around the world, and these will work. But the point I'm trying to make is that if they can, you know, unless they incorporate these literally trillions of dollars worth of revenue from the illegal drug business into the official economy, and you just try to make that those trillions of dollars of revenue and that whole thing disappear, you're going to have some very powerful, very dangerous people on your case, and this is not a wise fight to pick.
No, I absolutely agree, and you know, that's one of the things is that I support a legalization or decriminalization or something. And even if, you know, I always have a little bit of reservation about the drugs that are truly toxic to human life. You know, methamphetamine, heroin are the two that jump off the page at me. I have a little bit of a problem with you know, legalizing that. You know, but that's my personal bias. I just want to see us get into a situation that works, and I want to take the profit motive out of this, so the criminals lose their interest in it. So they have to go out and get honest jobs and do things that actually do create wealth.
Right, and now the other thing, of course, the other industry that really needs to be looked at, of course, is the international oil companies, and the mining companies and the ones that are going into these poor countries and with their mercenary armies and causing so much havoc. They have to be come under the rule of law. And that, of course, means fixing the international system so that it really represents the planet. And that, of course, leads us to the United Nations, which is very dysfunctional as it stands now. Trump has said he's going to cut their financing by 40%, I believe. I think it's time to move the UN out of the United States. And I've heard that that has actually been decided. There's three locations that they're looking at, apparently, for moving the UN headquarters. One is Nepal, right in the middle between India and China. Another is Laos. And a third is Nara, Japan, the sort of south of Kyoto. When you move it, you have to also restructure it so that it represents the planet as it is now, not as it was in 1945, where you had these big colonial empires, France and England, getting a seat and a veto. And right now, at four out of the five countries with a permanent veto are Western, and yet Westerners are only 17% of the world's population. That's obviously not right.
And also, among those, like you mentioned, France, that's a second-tier country these days. They are not truly a global power. There's three global powers today. It's the U.S., Russia, China. India could be, but they're not quite a global power yet. Mm-hmm. But, you are correct that the whole thing needs to be adjusted to fit what I call the current reality. Because it, like you said, it's an artifact. It's a holdover from the end of World War II. That's how it was set up.
Yeah, and these negotiations are taking place, but clearly the people who are the stakeholders in the current system are fighting tooth and nail to prevent that from happening. But I think that in the esoteric power level, the fact that the head of the Knights of Malta was fired recently, I think, is very
important. Yeah, yeah, he got fired by the Pope, no less.
Apparently, I have a source there. I asked them, and it was because they were trying to do another, cash some more trillion-dollar financial instruments, sort of like happened in 2008, and they were stopped. This was taking place in New York. They were going to try to create more trillions of dollars out of thin air and distribute it to their buddies and use it to bribe and assassinate their way, back into power. And it was stopped, which is a good thing. But there's still a deadlock there at that level, and that has to be resolved. And that means, right at a very esoteric level, the negotiations are between the Vatican, the P2, Rome, which secretly controls the U.S. military and the Federal Reserve Board, and China. That's where, and then with Russia as the mediator, that's where the negotiations are at the real world level now. And hopefully a deal can be reached soon for the planet.
Well, and you are correct, because we have some global challenges that no single country, no matter how wealthy or powerful they are, needs to address. And I go back to, we look at the care of the environment and how we're destroying the environment, the Pacific Ocean, the garbage patch, out in the middle there. You look at the Amazon rainforest, which are the lungs of the planet. It's a fraction of what it used to be. We deforested a good portion of North America. And all of these things, there has to be a measured response to how we do this, and we have to cooperate with each other. It doesn't do the U.S. any good to stop using coal, for instance, if China doesn't stop using coal. I mean, because the trade winds are the jet stream blows from China straight into the USA. We're breathing Chinese air pollution in this country on the West Coast. Here, like it or not, that's what we're doing. So
we are carbon-based life, right? So increasing biomass is one way to deal with all this carbon, and if you turn the Sahara, which is about the size of North, huge anyway, into a huge green dune. It would be like a place where people could, pioneers could go and start a new life. And you know, the technology's there to salt out of the ocean water and turn that into a green paradise. And then you could absorb all that carbon, you know? You know, there's so many things we could do. And getting back to this setting up a new future planning agency. Now, the Asians do say, all right, you know, you Westerners have run the world for the past 300 years. We want our turn to try too. So there's a secret agreement has been reached. They're willing to have a Westerner run this agency for the first term or whatever. Then they want an Asian to be in charge. And after that, you know, they're willing to have it, you know, go to whoever's the best person, regardless of if they're from Africa or from wherever, as long as they're the best person for the job. But they want their turn at in charge of global economic governance, and they've earned it. You know, the Chinese have lifted 700 million people out of poverty. They've done wonders in Africa and stuff. And their system developed by the Japanese and then used by the Singaporeans and the Chinese, it's a better system in many ways. I know.
It is. I ran a business out of Singapore for about 14, 15 years. And what Lee Kuan Yew put together down there is a remarkable achievement. Remarkable. And you look at their neighboring country of Malaysia or Indonesia, both, and they don't come close to being successful as a society, as an economic entity, as well as a cultural entity. Singapore stands head and shoulders above their neighbors in every measure.
Yeah, Singapore was as poor as they get anywhere in the world. Like, they were like right down there with the poorest parts of Africa or India at the end of World War II. Now they're the third richest country in the world. And they're still having fast economic growth. Now, I'm talking about per capita GDP here. The average Singaporean earns $82,000 a year. I just looked it up here on the internet. You know, that's a very convenient thing, isn't it?
It is.
and you know, 7 years ago, before Lee Kuan Yew got started, they were earning something like $100 or $200 a year, you know? Mm-hmm. And their model is one that we can use for Africa and for other places that still in India that still need, you know, somebody to plan for the future of the country as a whole and not just for their own personal profit, which is important too, but you can't run a planet that way.
Well, as I said, there's things we need to cooperate on, and you look at the West versus Africa, the Middle East, South America, other areas. The West has been very good at limiting. We read the literature, we took it to heart and said, look, we can't have as big of families as we used to have. And in the West, the average of children per offspring is like 1.82. And where it was 100 years ago, it was like 6. And so the West has done very good, but none of the other nations, other cultures, have managed to mitigate their birth rates. And so they're putting environmental pressure on the whole planet by their prolific breeding. And so how do we as a planet survive this when some in the West are embracing this concept of limiting family size and others are not? And so it speaks very, very loudly for what you're proposing here.
Well, here's the thing is that the idea of limiting population was based on the idea that we have limited resources. So one thing is we want to create new ecosystems, new environments, so that we can keep growing our populations. We can have, you know, trillions of human beings throughout the universe, you know, but that's the long-term goal. But yeah, right now, most of the world's population growth is concentrated in Africa and Europe, Russia, China, Japan, all these places that have developed are actually, you know, having negative population growth or heading that way because of the low fertility. But another way of looking at it is that the forces of evolution now favor the Africans. I mean, because it's survival of the, you know, the most reproductive. The other thing I think it was an Icelandic study that showed that the way that the system is set up now, evolution is selecting against education. In other words, the more educated people are, the less children they have on average. So natural selection is working against them. And I have an answer to that. which was the system they had in China, Imperial China, where anybody could apply for the Imperial exam. And if they passed, which is very, very difficult, but if they passed, they could be very rich and have like 20 wives and 200 kids, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And pass on their intelligence genes. And then after about three generations, that family would revert to the mean, and other, you know, geniuses would rise up and you know, and get the reproductive rewards. And we need to have that sort of system again, because right now, the way it's functioning now is that the least educated people are having the most kids. And that's probably not good in the long term for the planet.
Well, no, they made a movie about that, 7-8 years ago, called Idiocracy, where I'll quote Jimmy the Greek. He said, the dumbest ones have the most kids. And that's what we're suffering from here. I mean, you look at countries like Somalia, average IQ is 68. You look at Cameroon, average IQ is 64. Central African Republic, average IQ is 63. It's even lower. And, you know, and they breed prolifically. And so, you know, I think there's merit in that, but how do you, we need to have the infrastructure in place in order to even create these type of systems.
Well, there's no planning agency that can take care of problems like that in rational ways, you know. The other thing is IQ only really measures your ability to take an IQ test. I mean, the real IQ test is survival in the real world, you know. But anyway, all that aside, there's probably going to be a situation in Africa that will be somewhat like Saudi Arabia. If the Saudis did not have oil, you know, we'd probably still be occasionally being asked to give charity to the starving camel herders of Saudi Arabia, because, you know, it's like a country like Somalia in many ways, you know, without the oil. But what happened in Saudi Arabia is that all their economy was managed by expats and stuff. And I think that the Africans might be for a while like the Saudis, where everything's run by Chinese and Koreans and Westerners and stuff until they're, you know, properly developed and mature enough to, you know, take care of themselves better than they're doing now. That's probably going to have something along those lines. I mean, it's probably going to be necessary.
Well, I agree. And I think there is potential here for a planetary renaissance to occur.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, one of the things I want to see the U.S. government do is release those 7,000 patents that they have classified as top secret and national security reasons. I want to see those patents released. I want to see them. I want to see products develop out of them. You know, I want to see, you know, new energy sources so that we don't have to burn coal or oil or other things along those lines and get into these new energy. I want to see anti-gravity work. I know the U.S. government has patents on this. I know that they do. And I can cite two occasions that everyone is familiar with where they're deployed currently. One was in the lunar module that went up to on the Apollo missions. There was a device in there that mitigated the mass of the component that took them back to the orbiting Apollo capsule. Mm-hmm. The other one is in the B-2 bomber. Because if you look at the payload this thing carries, and you look at the wing, there's no way it can carry what it says it's carrying. There is an anti-gravity device in there. I'm sorry.
I read a Russian study. You know the famous story about how bumblebees shouldn't be able to fly? Well, apparently insects have anti-gravity, you know, according to this Russian study. And that's how it works, you know. There's all sorts of wonderful stuff that needs to be released. And I think this whole paranoid national security mindset that kept this, you know, kind of like a dog in the manger hogged up by certain elements of the military industrial complex has to end. And the only way to end that is to come up with a new world structure that can, you know, release this to everybody in a responsible manner. And that's what we're going to have to work towards. And we can do it this year if we do it right. And I think, you know, one more push and we can get over there and we can have it happen. And we can, you know, restructure the international architecture in a way that's benevolent for the planet without having to use a world war as a mechanism for getting that started. And with that thought, I think I've got to head out the door soon. But is there anything else that you want to discuss?
No. If you're pressed for time, then let's go ahead and take it there. I just wanted to you quickly. If you were to give the five most important things that should be done by the U.S. government or any other jurisdiction around the planet, what would they be? What would you suggest?
Well, one is build this future planning agency and then set up a mechanism so they could have trillions and trillions of dollars made available, away the right to make money from these private families and giving it to this public institution. The other is to restructure the United Nations so that it really represents the people of the planet. The third is to release all the hidden technology in a responsible manner. And then the other one is to start with a massive, massive campaign bigger than World War III to clean up this planet. And the overall message is, make love, not war. Let's get this started.
Well, you've articulated some very good things there. And I think on an immediate basis, cleaning up the environment, restoring it to a more pristine state should be very, very highly ranked up there. I was with a friend of mine, Carol Rosin, the other day, and she's of the opinion from people she talks to that we may have crossed a tipping point, that there may be no turning back to get the planet back to a environmentally, ecologically stable position.
And we could actually start creating new ecosystems and increasing biomass. We could double or triple the amount of life on this planet, including natural life, as long as we have the mechanisms to carry that out. That's what this planning agency could accomplish. But yeah, we need to do it. We need to get a sense of urgency. It's not something that we're going to do in 30 years from now. It's got to be done this year. We could start really next week if the mechanisms were put in place. And the bottom line, the key is the control of the process of creating and distributing money has to be a public asset owned by the people of the planet, not by a few secret families of Satan worshipers.
Well, it needs to be treated as utility, because all money is, it is a means of exchange. It's how you take your life force energy is exchanged to someone else for something created by their life force energy. That's all it is. Yep. And that should be treated as a public utility for use for everyone on the planet.
Absolutely. All right. Well, you have a nice day.
Ben, thank you so much for making the time. Appreciate it. And you have a great day and enjoy the rest of your morning.
And when there's been a more big sort of flood of changes, which are going to be happening over the next few months, let's talk again.
All right. Very good, sir. Thank you so much. Have a good afternoon. Bye. Bye-bye.